call Mr. Vice Chancellor, Mr. Leader of the Opposition, Madam Consul and other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the welcome and the invitation to be here. Thank you, Tracy, to the Business School, the University and the Economic Society for extending to me the honour of breaking your glasses now. The honour of delivering the 2010 Shan Lecture. Yes, I do remember a wide-eyed young Tracy Cumming, as she was then, who we thought was very promising, and then I knew we were trouble because she knew this guy called Jonathan and she was going back to get married, and I thought, yeah, well, we're not going to keep this young woman. And so it turned out, but it's delightful to see how successful you've been in making your contribution here in Perth. People are shaped by formative events, and Edward Owen Gidlin Shan was no exception. Born in Hobart in 1884, he moved with his family to Melbourne a few years after that. Growing up in the Depression of the 1890s, and that of course was an event which hit Victoria and Melbourne particularly hard, he saw firsthand the effect that financial crises could have on people's lives, and those memories and experiences stayed with him and motivated much of his life's work. In his early adult life, Shan exhibited some Fabian tendencies, and indeed a flirtation with the left was a not uncommon response by a later generation of intellectuals in the 1930s when capitalism seemed to have failed. But by the time Shan had become prominent as an economist, his views had shifted in a direction that I think we might today label libertarian, I would at least, having read his work. One of his most noted works was a short pamphlet published in 1927 that described the lead up to and the crash of the 1890s, and it was prescient in drawing certain parallels with developments in the 1920s that led up to the 1930s depression. The 1880s, of course, were characterized by a rapid population growth, increased urbanization, an investment boom that was dominated by construction. There was a spirit of optimism, which saw international capital flow in and asset prices, particularly land prices, increase. Leverage rose, lending standards fell. Sound familiar? As Shan's monograph noted, financial regulation at the time, in some sense, abetted these excesses, including what he termed an untimely amendment of the Victorian Banking Act in 1888, which allowed borrowing against a wider range of collateral. In the 1920s, when Shan was applying this experience to contemporary issues, the problem then was not so much excessive private borrowing. The problem he saw then was too much public borrowing. He viewed the extensive public works popular with state governments at that time as not only increasing debt, but lowering productivity. So it came as no surprise later that when Australia's terms of trade collapsed at the end of the 1920s and international capital markets closed to new borrowing, Shan was among the group that argued that the standard of living that could feasibly then be associated with full employment was noticeably below that to which people had become accustomed in the boom. The Premier's plan of 1931, which he had a hand in producing, sought to recognise that and to spread the associated loss of income across the different sectors of society. These two episodes, the 1890s and the 1930s, had important differences, but in a deeper sense, both stories were similar and all too familiar. The sequence goes like this. Some genuine improvement in economic conditions leads to more optimism. Maybe it's a resource discovery. Maybe it's some technological improvement. Maybe the terms of trade increase. Or maybe just people are more confident in the economic policy's capacity to solve problems. Human nature being what it is, people, or governments, or both, are inclined to project this into the future with undue confidence and insufficient regard to risk. They often decide to invest more in ventures that are marginal or even speculative. They borrow money to do so. Because their assessment of permanent income is that it has increased, they also decide to consume more now, either privately or through public services. Financial markets and institutions, populated after all by human beings as they are, make it feasible to do this by providing capital. And so the boom grows. Then at some point, some event causes people suddenly to realise that they've been too optimistic. Maybe the new paradigm disappoints in some way, maybe the terms of trade decline again, or whatever it is. And then the cycle goes into reverse, usually painfully. Well, that pattern, of course, is fresh in our minds after international events of recent years. But Shan was writing about this 75 years ago. And of course, he wasn't the first. Narratives like these are peppered throughout history. The thought that, quote, this time it's different, unquote, springs eternal in the human psyche, and it's a fitting title to the recent work by Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, entitled It's Different This Time, which covers 8 centuries of financial folly. Moreover, and that's how far back this goes, financial instruments, markets and institutions are always central to the way these cycles play out. So it's fitting, I think, given Shan's own work and given circumstances, to ask the question, what is the role of finance? And so that's my theme. In particular, I want to take up 4 questions. What are the desirable features of the financial system and how did they originate? What problems are inherent in finance and how have policymakers responded to that? What questions arise from the growth and change of the financial system over the past couple of decades? And finally, what are the challenges as we look ahead? So firstly, the functions of the financial system and its origins. What is it that we want the financial system to do? Well, I think there are 5 things that we want it to do. We want it to provide a reliable way of making payments, of exchanging value between people. We want it to price and pool certain types of risk. We want it to transfer resources from savers to borrowers. And then we want it to transfer the resources back again in the form of returns from the borrowers to the savers. And that, of course, requires that the savers' money not get lost. And that, in turn, requires monitoring of the borrowers and the managers of the money. And then finally, we want the financial system to provide liquidity. People want, to some extent, a liquid claim against the wealth that the community has. These are very valuable things to have. The modern economy would not have developed in the way it has without these capabilities arising in the financial system. Now, we tend to think of financial activity and innovation as very recent, but in fact, the history is a long one. We can't go into that in detail tonight, and there are some very good books around at present. I know that Professor Neil Ferguson was recently in Western Australia, and his book, The Ascent of Money, is a very accessible treatment on the history of finance. It's clear, though, that borrowing and lending is almost as old as civilization itself. The evidence for these kind of transactions, many of them are remarkably codified, go back at least as far as the 18th century BC in Babylonian records. Scholars suggest that the records of the Greek and Roman ages show considerable evidence of activities we would call banking. Things accelerated during the Renaissance in Italy. By that time, bills of exchange were commonly in use as a means to both facilitate trade and also to circumvent laws against usury. We're told that on occasion traders could take a deposit in one city, lend to somebody transporting goods to another city, take repayment at the end, possibly even in a different currency, with a suitable addition to the price in lieu of the interest, of course. So that activity would appear to be a forerunner by seven centuries of an instrument that we would think of as combining elements of a zero coupon security, trade credit, and a kind of foreign exchange swap. The most noted bankers of that era, of course, were the Medicis, who went further than their predecessors in developing pooling of credit risk, in having a branch network with partners remunerated in terms of a profit share. Development of double entry bookkeeping in the 1340s in Genoa also helped banking assume its more modern features. This form of banking in Italy later became a model for Holland, Sweden and England, to which further innovations were added. In Amsterdam, the Wissel Bank, the first exchange bank in Northern Europe, pioneered the system of checks and direct debits, circumventing problems with different currencies. The Swedish Riksbank, formed in 1656 and recognised today as the oldest institution we would call a central bank, is credited by some as having pioneered fractional reserve banking. Other innovations were joint stock ownership and limited liability, which allowed more capital to find its way into banking and lower the costs of intermediation. The Bank of England was established in 1694, and it was for many years the only institution called the privilege of joint stock structure, although that was later extended. And Walter Bagehot, in his classic book Lombard Street, devotes a chapter to the virtues of joint stock ownership of corporations and banks. And those kind of innovations, of course, helped develop equity markets more generally. Bond markets also developed. Here again, Renaissance Italy is prominent, where wealthy citizens were able to buy bonds and thereby invest their savings in one of the few things which they regarded as offering a high rate of return, namely financing wars. These sorts of instruments allowed governments and later corporations to raise funds from a broader set of sources. In time, the formation of secondary markets allowed markets to price the risk. Those innovations ultimately spread north, and by the mid-18th century, London had a well-developed bond market. Of course, it was working in the bond market that made the Rothschild family wealthy, and for much of the 19th century, their bank was the largest in the world. So, far from finance being a particularly recent invention, by the middle of the 19th century, quite a sophisticated financial system had arisen in Western countries. It included banks and other financial intermediaries, stock and bond markets and insurance. It allowed transactions to be made. It mobilised pools of saving for investment and enterprise while offering a degree of liquidity to savers. It pooled certain risks and it served, in a fashion at least, to monitor borrowers. It allowed payments to be made and funds invested across national borders. In the process, of course, it facilitated the Industrial Revolution, which resulted in the biggest transformation in living standards ever seen in Western civilization. This system did just about all the things we would want a financial system to do today, albeit with less technological efficiency. In fact, I suspect that if we could take a financier from those days and put them in Wall Street today, the thing they would most notice would not be the new instruments, nor the crises, but the effects of the silicon chip and fiber optics on the way that finance is conducted in the modern world. Incidentally, the difficulties that accompany not having a financial system, or only having a rudimentary one, were nowhere better illustrated than in the early Australian colonies, and one of Shand's other works, An Economic History of Australia, makes this quite clear. The most commonly used means of exchange for some years in Sydney, of course, was rum. Shand reports that in Sydney, And I quote, George Street between Brickfield Hill and Bridge Street costs 400 gallons of rum to build, unquote. That's a distance of about 2 kilometres. In today's prices for rum, that's about $80,000, so I'm told by people who drink rum. It is doubtful that a road of that length could be constructed for that sum today. Such has been the increase in the price of labour in terms of rum, or for that matter, anything else. The colonists, of course, began to issue notes or cards, forms of IOUs, which circulated as money. The problem of that was that the quality of those IOUs varied and tended to decline over time. Then there was the episode where Governor Macquarie's famously sought to ease the shortage of metallic currency in the colony by punching holes through a consignment of Spanish dollar coins and giving the ring and the duff different values and so making them less valuable elsewhere and seeking to retain that money in the colony. But the need for credit facilities to fund pastoral expansion and trade and so on still required the development of a banking system. And so in 1817, Macquarie granted a charter to a group of leading traders and officials to form the Bank of New South Wales, today known as Westpac, Australia's oldest company, which was given also the responsibility to issue a paper currency. Shan points out that the stockholders in that bank were given limited liability. At that time, in England, still an exclusive privilege of the Bank of England, and that would remain so for another 40 years. So despite a somewhat shaky start, we can argue that Australia's own financial system was able to catch up quickly to those of more advanced countries by adopting their technologies, in some cases more quickly than they did. So that's the functions of finance and its origins. What about the problems that came? Well, as banking developed, it became more leveraged. It wasn't any longer a case of a few wealthy individuals risking their own money in what was really akin to venture capital and accepting the risk and illiquidity that went with that. Banks, as they developed, raised deposits from the public, redeemable at their face value, at notice, or even at court. Now, leverage changes the dynamics of any business, and this is the purpose for it. I don't need to tell you that here. Expected returns are higher, but management needs to be more on their game. And that's an often quoted argument for having some debt in a corporation. In the case of banks, this meant that the business of banking became even more focused on the monitoring of the borrowers, information gathering, risk management, and so on. Of course, the depositors had some protection in that the capital of the proprietors was going to be at risk before the deposits. But banks also undertook and still undertake a maturity transformation. That is, they offer depositors liquidity, but they hold only a fraction of their own assets in liquid form. The whole thing depended, and still does, on confidence. If the depositors wanted their funds back en masse, the bank wouldn't be able to provide it because not all of its assets were in cash. If there was a loss of confidence for some reason, the bank then could be subject to a run. So banks themselves needed access to liquidity in situations of stress. They needed to be able to liquefy some of their own assets to meet a crisis of confidence. Well, if such a shock is idiosyncratic, affecting only one bank, maybe that bank could seek funding in the market. And indeed, some of its competitors, mindful of the possibility of contagion, might well temporarily support it, as long as there was a reasonable expectation of solvency. But if the confidence shock was more systemic in nature, the question then was, how do you support the whole system? And this is where the role of the central bank came through successive crises to be understood. It was ultimately encapsulated in Badgett's famous, if widely misquoted, maxim that the central bank should be prepared under those circumstances to, quote, lend freely against good collateral at a high rate of interest, unquote. But while the provision of liquidity in crises left the system less vulnerable to runs, it wasn't really a solution to simple bad lending. Even if all the good assets can be liquefied to meet a run, if not all the assets are good, failure may still occur. Failures of individual institutions could be allowed, provided that that didn't damage confidence in other institutions, but it's always difficult to know just how small or large a failure might cross the threshold there. Inevitably, since there could be spillovers from failures, and since banks and others would accept funds from the general public, there was always going to end up being a degree of regulation. And so the history of banking and finance is not just a history of financial innovation, it's also a history of regulatory response. That regulatory response, moreover, has had its own quite pronounced cycles over time, and we're witnessing one now. Regulation itself, moreover, prompts further innovation by the system, and so on. From the 1930s, regulation became much more intrusive. In the US, we saw the fear of the so-called money power result in some large institutions like JP Morgan being broken up, much as occurred in some other industries there at the time. Yet simultaneously, competition between banks was intentionally curtailed in some respects for fear of irrational behaviour. Regulatory intervention extended to interest rates, reserve requirements, prohibitions on certain kinds of business, and even in some countries, lending guidelines and quotas. In the 1940s, all of this in many countries became part of the wartime apparatus through which governments sought to run economies without much resort to the price mechanism. It persisted in finance for many years after the war, perhaps in part to keep low the costs of servicing very large debts which had accumulated during the war. It was really only in the 1980s and 90s that regulatory approach finally passed, allowing banks to compete vigorously for all lines of business and allowing pricing to be driven by market forces. And we can see many of these same trends in our own country. The 1937 Royal Commission in Australia argued for much greater control and regulation of the monetary and banking systems, motivated by the shortcomings of the system during the 30s and the even bigger shortcomings in the 1890s. Legislation on many of those recommendations was enacted in 1945, and it continued the tight controls put on the banks during the war. So the focus immediately after the war was on stability with little regard to efficiency. And that was consistent with extensive government intervention and regulations in many sectors of the economy. So in the early post-war period, the Australian banking system was highly constrained. We used to tell banks what interest rates to charge and to pay. There were restrictions on terms of to maturity with different types of deposits and loans, quantitative and qualitative controls on lending in aggregate and even to particular types of borrowers. These were introduced to guard against excessive risk-taking by banks in order to safeguard depositors' savings, and they were also regarded as serving the needs of macroeconomic policy at that time. Given the pervasive nature of those controls, it's maybe not that surprising that the system was very stable for a long time. After the early 1930s, it was nearly five decades before an Australian bank got into serious trouble again with the Bank of Adelaide in 1979. And that actually is, in a sense, a result of the terrible 1890s experience, which was so influential on Shan. Selwyn Cornish has pointed out that that episode had a significant effect on the nature and form of regulation and policy generally through much of the 20th century. But the constrained banking system left a gap into which others began to step. As early as the 1960s, new and less regulated institutions began to arise. The bank's share of financial intermediation in the country began to fall. And by the mid-1980s, it had reached just over half. And nearly half of the intermediation was being done by other institutions. The increasing size and complexity of the system, the rise of non-bank institutions, and so on, made the regulatory architecture less effective. And by the late 70s, the philosophical tide was turning against regulatory intervention anyway, not just in finance, but in general. And so eventually all of this led to calls for liberalisation. And so about 40 years after the